Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Lowy Institute this afternoon. I'm Michael Foolilove, the director, and I'm delighted to welcome you all to today's event on Australia and nuclear non-proliferation and nuclear disarmament with two eminent Australians, Gareth Evans and Michael Kirby. Ladies and gentlemen, I've known and admired our guests for many years. They are both eminent reforming lawyers. Michael Kirby was head of the Law Reform Commission, judge of the Federal Court of Australia, president of the New South Wales Court of Appeal, and justice of the High Court of Australia. I met Michael for the first time 25 years ago, he probably doesn't remember, when I was the editor of On Issoir at the University of Sydney. I went to his chambers to interview him. I walked in, I was very intimidated. He was standing with his back to me, still robed, looking out onto Sydney Harbour. And he said, without turning around, the last time I met an editor of On Issoir, I sacked him. He's also a rare Australian figure who's played a significant role on the world stage, having chaired the UN Commission of Inquiry on North Korea. And in this public setting, I'd also like to congratulate Michael on his recent marriage to his partner of 50 years, Johan van Vleuten. Congratulations. Thank you. Gareth has had an equally illustrious career. He was an academic and a barrister before being elected to Parliament. He served as Australia's Attorney General and later as Foreign Minister from 1988 to 1996. Many observers rank him as our finest Foreign Minister. When he was Minister, Australian foreign policy certainly had shape and purpose. Gareth also occupied an important international role as President of the International Crisis Group. He co-chaired two major international commissions on intervention and state sovereignty and on nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament. And since 2010, he has served as Chancellor of the Australian National University. Ladies and gentlemen, we would be hard-pressed to find two more qualified and interesting people to talk on one of the great issues facing humanity, and that is nuclear disarmament, nuclear non-proliferation. And it's particularly timely to do it now, because it may well be that the next government of Australia puts a lot of effort into this issue. I'd like to introduce the moderator now of today's discussion, Lowy Institute Research Director Alex Oliver. Alex is a mainstay of the Institute. Like me, she's a lapsed lawyer. She made her name with her groundbreaking work for us in public opinion polling and diplomacy, and she now oversees the Institute's research program. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Gareth Evans, Michael Kirby, and Alex Oliver to the stage.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. Speaking of intimidation, in the 15 years of the Lowy Institute, we have run, I think, close to 1,000 Lowy Institute lectures, and I can say there have been very few with such an eminent panel, and I'm completely intimidated. But we've had a couple of minutes discussion before we walked in here, and it's going to be feisty, so hang on to your hats, buckle up, and get ready for the ride. Michael, I want to start with you. In a joint statement in 1987, US President Ronald Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev declared in a joint statement that a nuclear war cannot be won and must not be fought. So as a distinguished jurist, both nationally and internationally, you've spent much of your career grappling with that sort of moral question. The Reagan-Gorbachev entreaty never to engage in nuclear war was made more than 30 years ago. Does it carry the same urgency now for you? What has changed?
Well, what has changed is there are more nuclear weapon states. The International Court of Justice has said that the weapon states must engage in bona fide negotiations towards nuclear non-proliferation and destruction of stockpiles, and they have not done that. Indeed, they've been resistant to steps in the correct direction. The increase in the number of states that are nuclear armed is particularly worrying, because some of them, certainly one of them, North Korea, is a very unstable, cruel autocracy, as the report of the Commission of Inquiry demonstrated. We've also come to know more clearly the dangers of accidents and mistakes. There have been two very serious accidental situations, and we therefore appreciate that. I think, as well as that, there's something that I haven't actually seen written about, but it is that the Westphalian system of the nation state is out of joint with the problems of the current age. Those problems are existential problems of the whole species. The climate change debate, the poverty, grinding poverty in many countries, the excellent issue of The Economist 2 weeks ago about water, and existential issues need new thinking. And that's where the non-proliferation treaty came in, and that's where the ban treaty comes in. The treaty to prevent, delegitimise nuclear weapons. So I think that's a sort of thumbnail sketch of what has changed. But we have to have a serious sense of urgency, because otherwise nothing will be done. And if nothing is done, I think it's a real question as to whether our species will still be on this planet in 100 years' time, or maybe 50 years' time, or maybe 20 years' time.
Of existential threats. Gareth, you're the global authority on nuclear disarmament. I think that's fair to say after chairing that International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, handed down in a decade ago now. And in a speech to the Eminent Elders Group in London late last year, you argued that there were two existential threats, which are the biggest issues facing the world today. One was nuclear arms, and the other one was global warming. But nuclear weapons, you said, can kill us a lot faster than CO2. So how do you think we should approach disarmament and non-proliferation now? You talked in that speech about four Ds.
Must approach it with a hell of a lot more vigour than the international community seems presently minded to do, other than in the particular context of North Korea at the moment. The truth of the matter is that nuclear weapons are the most indiscriminately inhumane weapons ever invented. And they do have this capacity to destroy life on this planet as we know it. And there's only one other area of policy failure which can have such catastrophic consequences, and that is climate change. But that's a much more protracted process, as we've said. I think the best way of describing the problem is in the language of the Canberra Commission on the Elimination of Nuclear Weapons, which the Keating government set up and was my last swan song before we left office. The subsequent government did nothing whatsoever to carry forward the conclusions of that. But they summarise in a very simple three-sentence mantra, I think, what the nature of the current problem is, and it's this. So long as any state retains nuclear weapons, others will want them. So long as any state retains nuclear weapons, has nuclear weapons, they are bound one day to be used, if not by deliberate design, then by accident, human error, system error, human idiocy. And any such use is bound to be catastrophic for life on this planet as we know it. So that states the task ahead of us. And it's absolutely critical that we get our act together. We have succeeded, interestingly, in dramatically reducing the number of nuclear weapons in the period immediately after the end of the Cold War. There was a reduction from something like 70,000 nuclear weapons down to the present 14,500. But that's still enough to kill us many hundreds of times over. And the reality is we still have 7,000 weapons in the possession of Russians, 6,500 in the United States, about 1,000 with the other states put together. And between them, the possibility of a catastrophe occurring, more likely, in my judgment, by human error, system error, implications of cyber sabotage and the new environment impacting on communications and people misreading situations in a context where, see, of these 14,500 weapons, a great many of them are actually deployed rather than just being tucked away in storage, nearly half of them. And of those, at least 2,000 are on hair trigger alert, capable of being fired in an absolute instant. And we've learnt, not just from the two cases I think Michael was referring to, but there's over and over and over again, as the archives are unopened for the Cold War years, we find out how close we came. So my judgment has always been it's sheer dumb luck rather than anything to do with statesmanship or rather than anything to do with the inherent stability of the system. that we've survived as long as we have. And one final point in the context, particularly of situations like India, Pakistan, the command and control systems are not nearly as sophisticated as they are alleged to have been or stated to have been as between Soviet Union and United States during the Cold War years. So errors of judgment can very quickly and very catastrophically lead to major conflagrations, which will have not just regional but worldwide implications.
And then of course, there's a crazy rocket man. But Michael, I wanted to ask you about the nuclear ban treaty and then have a chat with you both about the international legal framework and the treaty on the non-proliferation treaty, which is 1970, and this much more recent treaty, the ban treaty, it's called, the prohibition on nuclear weapons, which was in 2017. You make the strong moral case for the nuclear ban treaty. Can you give me an idea of what is your case for that treaty and how does it why it's more important or equally important to the older treaty, which was the non-proliferation treaty?
The ban treaty attempts to respond to the moral problem of the existence of huge nuclear danger. The two accidental cases, one was the Cuba missile and the other was the so-called Petrov false reading of missiles allegedly sent to Russia to blow up the Soviet Union in its capital. But that later turned out to have been simply clouds that were being misinterpreted in the state of the technology of that time. We're running into an age where the call of both of the major nuclear powers, the Russian Federation and the United States, is to get some strategic nuclear weapons. These are cute little nuclear weapons that can be used in the battle field context. And far from making things safer, that would make things much more dangerous, I think. So that the moral question is so much more powerful now, including by reason of the retreat of the United States of America from multilateralism, the denunciation of treaties by the United States, including one in the nuclear field, and therefore the question is, what are we going to do about it? Those who oppose the ban treaty, I think, have got to really say what they will put in its place to answer the call of the International Court of Justice. In 1996, in its advisory opinion, it said, to the surprise, I think, of a lot of international lawyers, that the possession, use and threat of use of nuclear weapons was not criminal. They couldn't find a basis for making it criminal. Judge Weeramantry of Australia and a number of the other judges said it was criminal. But
in the context of existential risk and self-defence, not in the context of affirmative use. I mean, the court was pretty strong
on affirmative use. But they did say in their advisory opinion that the price of this approach, which is a nuanced approach, was that the nuclear weapon states had to enter into bona fide negotiations. Well, far from doing that, we've got a situation where it's actually got worse and where there is bullying by some of the nuclear weapon states to ensure that countries like Australia will not do what they consider is in the best interests of humanity, the biosphere, and their own citizens. So this is where we stand, and it really is on those who resist the ban treaty. It's the 7th of the 7th, 17. So it's easy to remember when it came. It requires 50 ratifications. It already has 23 ratifications. They include very serious countries like New Zealand, the Irish Republic, Austria, Mexico, Thailand and others, and really down here where we are, the strong pressure is on us to say, well, why cannot we go down the path that New Zealand, feisty New Zealand, you know, I went to Vienna recently on a thing on drugs. The same bullies were there trying to stop the international community deal with the issue of the drug treaties. And New Zealand was there saying, ultimately you have to ask a question when you're not addressing a big problem. Why can't we address it? What is the problem? And so the issue in Australia is going to be, is it impossible for us to maintain our treaty arrangements with the United States of America for our defence and also ratify the ban treaty? And if not, do we choose one course or the other?
Well, speaking of feisty New Zealand, and I know you're going to come right in on top of this one, George Shultz said at the time that New Zealand, or the US, withdrew its security umbrella from New Zealand because of Wellington port call on the nuclear-armed warships. He said, we part as friends, but we part company as far as the alliance is concerned. And, of course, that might be equally relevant to Australia's situation as if it were to follow feisty New Zealand down this path and sign and ratify this treaty.
Well, let's unpick the issues about the ban treaty. For start, it was negotiated by 122 members of the United Nations, about two-thirds of the total number, and it was a very important normative step forward, because rather than the indirect language, the useless language of the non-proliferation treaty in Article 6, which requires people to negotiate in good faith towards disarmament, this is a treaty which says for those who sign up to it, you have to eliminate all your nuclear weapons. You can't possess them, you can't develop them, you can't transfer them, you can't receive them, and you can't use or threaten to use them under any circumstance. An absolute, clear-cut, vividly articulated prohibition. And that is overdue, to have something out there like the Chemical Weapons Convention, like the Biological Weapons Convention. And normatively, I yield to no one in my admiration of it, and nor do I think for a second it is in any way inconsistent with the terms of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. You've got this rather feeble argument that you can't have this with its heavy-duty obligations sitting alongside the NPT with its less rigorous things, and there might be some disturbance or inability for the NPT to stay the course. And, I mean, they're almost impossible to articulate the nature of the objection, but it's basically bullshit. The NPT stands alone, ban treaty stands alone, they don't get in the way of each other, they're arguably mutually reinforcing. So why on earth should we not immediately sign it? Ratify it? Let me give the answer.
May I? What about the section in the treaty? I'm coming to that.
I'm just step by step.
He's asked a question. He's now going to give his own answer.
Silly me.
Yeah, but I mean, leave to one side for a minute the US alliance thing. Just look at the treaty in its own terms. This treaty is not going to do the job that we want it to do. It really is aspirational rather than operational. Its preambular paragraphs outweigh, in terms of the content of the treaty, anything remotely operational in it. And there are a number of things in it which mean that it is absolutely certain that the nuclear armed states will not sign up to it. And quite apart from the position of partners and allies of the nuclear armed states, which I'll come to in a second. Why won't the nuclear armed states sign up to it? Well, basically four reasons. One, it makes no effective provision at all for verification. So if you give up your nuclear weapons, you sign it and you enter into a commitment to eliminate, there's nothing to ensure in the terms of the treaty itself that there'll be any kind of effective, credible verification mechanism so that you know when someone's cheating on that commitment. Secondly, but there is a reference to establishing some body in due course, but that's not given any content. Secondly, there's no provision at all about enforcement. What the hell do you do if, having given up nuclear weapons, and everybody's given them up, a rogue state comes and re-establishes their nuclear armory? Rely on the Security Council with the veto rights of the existing weapons. There's just no mechanism at all, and nobody has articulated conceptually a way of finding a mechanism in the present environment. A third problem is that it's a technical one, but it's an important one, is that the safeguards provisions of the treaty are less strong for non-signatories to the treaty than they are for those who join the treaty. I mean, let me put that in slightly less arcane terms. The safeguards provisions in the treaty that the nuclear weapon states are required to sign up to commit them to a higher standard in terms of safeguards than countries that don't sign up to the treaty. And that's something that really will matter. And the fourth problem is that in signing the treaty, you are committed, under the express terms of the treaty, to a time-bound elimination of your weapons armoury. You can't make your final step away conditional on other people doing the same. It's got to be time-bound. And frankly, nobody is going to do that in an environment where there's uncertainty as to what the other nuclear armed states are actually doing. So there's, it's a long and complicated argument, but there are four very key reasons why it's just not operational. It can't possibly work and won't ever be committed to. The issue for the allies and partners is a different one. And that is, in Australia's case, it would be absolutely impossible for us to sign the treaty without being in fundamental breach of our alliance commitment to the US. Now, you might have all sorts of reservations about the current salience of that commitment, particularly under the Trump administration, whether it ever means anything in practice. But I don't think anyone really wants to walk away, to
tear up, as you've said.
Why does it have that implication? Because Article 1E of the treaty, after articulating all these other prohibitions, said that what you cannot do is assist, encourage, or induce in any way anyone to engage in any activity prohibited by a state party under this treaty. Now, Australia's hosting of the Northwest Cape Communications Centre, Australia's hosting the Pine Gap facility, both of which are absolutely crucial to CCC communications control command mechanisms of the United States. It's communication with submarines, it's satellite surveillance, it's early warning. It's inconceivable that we could continue to host those facilities if we were signatories to the treaty. And it's inconceivable that we can somehow separate out the nuclear stuff from the non-nuclear stuff. It just can't be done technically. So that would be the end of the treaty. And you know, you just have to be aware of those consequences. You can't have the luxury, as some of the ban treaty people are saying, oh, well, you can just step away from the nuclear part of the alliance and still keep the conventional relationship. I mean, realistically, that's just not going to be achievable. So as much as I love the normative commitment that's involved in the treaty and the path-breaking way in which we're so explicit about it, it's not going to work in practice, and I'm afraid it's not going to work either practically or politically for Australia.
Well, I think that's a very all or nothing type of approach, and Gareth hasn't really said what he would put in its place would actually do something about this situation. And the fact is that the treaty that we're talking of was a treaty of 1951. That treaty made no reference to nuclear umbrellas. It made no reference to nuclear weapons specifically. Certainly in the case of New Zealand, with a different configuration of relationships, they have taken their step, and they walked away as friends, but they've retained defence relationships. They've simply stepped out of nuclear relationships. New Zealand and we signed the Rarotonga Agreement about the South Pacific being a nuclear-free zone. New Zealand has taken these steps, and they're still included in the Five Eye intelligence arrangements. And it may be that the very things that Gareth has mentioned, that we're hosting things that are essential to nuclear weapons, is a very good reason why Australia has to really reconsider whether we should be hosting those things or whether we should be taking steps to encourage the United States of America. After all, did the United States of America talk at length with Canada and Mexico about its denunciation of the North American trade agreement? Did it negotiate with its other allies in NFT treaty denunciation? I mean, they are America first. They're America the greatest. And that is not going to be safe for humanity. So we've got to do something about it.
I've got a lot of sympathy with the proposition that hosting those facilities is possibly on balance more likely to make us a nuclear target than to guarantee us protection in the event that we were ever subject to an existential threat. But look, the truth of the matter is, both sides of Australian politics, I think rightly, have made the judgment that whatever the horror show being perpetrated by this narcissistic buffoon, ethically challenged, who now runs the United States, and all that sails with him, and is likely to sail with him for the indefinitely foreseeable future, I fear. Notwithstanding that, we have an enormous amount to lose if we tear up the alliance relationship. It's not only logistic and intelligence support and so on, it is the reality that we have 12,000 miles, forgotten what it is, in kilometres of coastline to protect, rather more than New Zealand, and a rather more volatile part of the world. And even though I'm a big fan of defence self-reliance, the reality is, if we were ever subjected to a really existential threat, we could not do it without the support of an international partner of the strength of the United States. Whether the United States would actually come to our aid in those circumstances is not something I make assumptions about, but it's a hell of a risk to take, and no Australian community...
Well, it's interesting that we agreed, and we, I think it was during your time as Foreign Minister, we claimed the protection of the nuclear umbrella, yeah. But the United States has rather cagily never itself acknowledged that.
No, that's perfectly true.
There have been statements in policy documents and so on, but they've never committed themselves use a nuclear weapon in our defence.
Conceptually, of course, it's perfectly possible, and I think the world should, the allies and partners of the United States, rely on conventional extended deterrence, not nuclear deterrence. I mean, I think it's a complete bust, the whole idea of nuclear deterrence, which I've written about at nauseous length in multiple places, in every context in which nuclear deterrence is argued to add value, there are very strong counter-arguments that if anything is creating more risk than it's resolving, even for small states relying on nukes as a sort of counterbalance to superior conventional capability elsewhere. But the short point I want to make is that none of this means you don't do anything about the nuclear disarmament problem. And I've certainly got plenty to say about that because
nothing much has been done until came along.
Yeah, people talk about the desirability not of a ban treaty but a step-by-step approach, but in practice have done absolutely nothing to advance a step-by-step approach. What I did, co-chairing the International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament with my Japanese former foreign ministerial co-chair, was come up with a report under the Rudd government which articulated a way forward, which is, I think, much more realistic. And it is to think in terms of nuclear disarmament as being not an inevitable path, uninterrupted, step by step, but rather a completely disaggregated two-stage process. And with the first stage, you seek, and with a realistic prospect of achieving, minimization of nuclear weapons numbers and impact. And then you move after that to the stage of elimination when you're down to very low numbers, but recognising that it's not a one-line continuum because there are gigantic problems of verification and enforcement, quite apart from psychological and geopolitical, which are going to inhibit that last step. And the step-by-step process, really, there's four priorities which we should be out there really, really proselytising for. And without going into detail, one is no first use doctrine. Second is de-alerting, take those 2,000 weapons off the hair trigger alert they're on at the moment. Third is deployment, dramatically reduce the number of the strategic weapons that are currently deployed. And fourthly, work very, very hard at reducing the numbers from the 14,500 we have at the moment down to 2,000 or so, and then work on that basis toward ultimate elimination. Nobody thinks that's an optimal, final solution, but a world in which we had a universal commitment to no first use, a world in which we had dramatically reduced deployed numbers, dramatically reduced overall numbers, and none but a handful of weapons, probably on submarines, on instant usability alert status, would be a hell of a lot safer and saner than the world we're in at the moment. So that's the strategy that I'm urging on various people around the world and certainly on the incoming Labor government, not to do nothing, which the present government has done, but to work very hard for that kind of agenda, which I think is not unrealistic at all.
Well, the plain fact of the matter is that the international community got fed up with talking about it, saying something must be done, it's extremely dangerous, we've got to do something. Your ideas may, in a theoretical situation, be right, but when we sat on the Law Reform Commission in Australia in our own little world, we knew that you don't always achieve everything immediately. You have to consider taking it step by step. At the moment, nothing is getting done, and on the contrary, bullies are trying to force countries from pursuing something which would delegitimize the use of nuclear weapons, and that is something that the ban treaty achieves. So,
I'm going to let you guys duke this out.
Okay.
All in favour of the treaty, but stop, not going to get us there. So we do need a parallel step-by-step process, which will get us there.
Well, okay, you can do that. What happened to the Canberra Commission? whatever happened to this talk shop and so on? This is the problem.
It has the same normative significance as the ban treaty does.
Right, now we need to talk about North Korea. Not Kevin, North Korea. And the problem of small states that you raised. And this is really the thing that has brought this denuclearisation dilemma into very sharp relief at the moment, which is its missile testing, the US reaction to that. We've seen the second Trump-Kim summit and a failure to achieve any progress on denuclearisation that I can see. But human rights were conspicuously absent from those negotiations. And Michael, you chaired that 2013 Commission of Inquiry into North Korea and reported, I think it was exactly 5 years to this day, St. Patrick's Day 2014, back to the United Nations on the conditions in North Korea and the DPRK's complete lack of observance of basic provisions of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. You described DPRK's engagement with the UN Human Rights Framework as reluctant, suspicious, hostile, or purely nominal. So where should, in your view, the human rights issue fit within these broader negotiations, not just between the United States and North Korea, but between the international community and North Korea? And how do we address these atrocities?
Well, anybody who has actually read the report of the Commission of Inquiry, which I chaired and presented, as you said, 5 years ago, would understand that the idea of having a world in which a country like North Korea has developed for itself not only nuclear weapons but a remarkable technology of missiles for the delivery of those weapons over very great distances, including the distance to Australia, is a pipe dream. And therefore, the notion of getting a solution in the case of North Korea without radical change in its society, its democracy, its engagement with its citizens, its feeding of its population. I mean, I think the most upsetting moment in our inquiry was when I was sitting there as an ex-Australian judge hearing about the bodies in the prison camps that were thrown out of the huts that look remarkably like, in the satellite imagery, the huts at Belsen and Auschwitz. They were put out at night and they were picked up in the morning and taken away, put on a vat, reduced to ashes, scattered on the nearby fields. I mean, this was something so monstrous. And to think that you can have a deal with that sort of society is really, I think, a pipe dream. So you can't ignore the human rights. You're not going to get nuclear non-proliferation and stockpile removal and so on the Korean Peninsula and peace and security, which is everybody's objective and which has a human rights element to it. You're not going to get that whilst nothing is done about human rights in North Korea.
I yield to no one my admiration of Michael's commission report. It's an absolutely outstanding document. It documents brilliantly, meticulously, the scale of the savagery, the autocracy, the grotesqueness of the human rights environment.
Get to the criticism.
Okay. It's fine, but the question is, how do you change that? I mean, the country has proved itself totally impervious to external sanctions pressure from any source in any context whatsoever, which has often been limp, that pressure, but even when it's sought to be applied a bit more, it just makes no difference. This is not that kind of society. The only way you're ever going to get improvement in the human rights environment is by somehow normalising North Korean society and getting it to be a more normal country, involving a degree of engagement and, you know, just opening it up and letting that process unfold. Trying to bring the human rights dimension into the present nuclear negotiations and making that yet another sort of precondition for taking the sanctions off It's just, I mean, a recipe for not only not getting anywhere on the human rights issue, but I think also a recipe of not getting anywhere on the nuclear issue. You would probably say, well, there's no chance, you've just said, there's no chance of getting anywhere on the nuclear issue because of the kind of society that it is. I'm much more optimistic than that. I do think that the present leadership, as bizarre as it is in so many ways, Kim Jong-un, does basically want to move forward economically, does want to engage with the South, and recognise that his longevity is perhaps going to be limited unless he can start dramatically improving the quality of life for his own people. So you've got a potential capacity to move forward with incentives externally to economic advancement and removal of sanctions and all the rest of it. And I think that that does play into the nuclear judgment that he's going to make. He's not going to, North Korea is not going to, abandon their nuclear weapons capability unless they feel confident that they're no longer at security risk of being invaded, intervened for human rights or any other reason. So the trick is to somehow manage these negotiations to deal with this reality. I don't take the view at all that North Korea will feel itself forever dependent on nuclear weapons for its security and survival. It has something that Iraq lacked and Libya lacked and others that have been thought to be absolutely irreducible, impossible resistors to nuclear disarmament had they not been walked over. North Korea does have an extraordinary deterrent capability right now in terms of the ring of fire, the artillery, the 100,000 or so rocket launchers and missiles that has pointed at Seoul from 30, 40, 50 kilometres away, which everybody acknowledges would produce 100,000 casualties, deaths in the first hour, God knows how many more after that, and would be very, very difficult to knock out. So it does have a sort of a guarantee, which I think, provided that you can move forward towards the sort of process that Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, has been mapping out. You put on the table a declaration of peace. You walk away from that state of war, which still formally consists. You begin to develop the interaction between the two communities. You create an environment, and you give the North Koreans the security guarantees that they crave and credibly back those security guarantees with a whole network of other commitments. I think you can move forward, but you're only ever going to be able to move forward on a step-by-step basis. And the kind of position the United States has now got itself into, clearly driven by John Bolton, the catastrophically awful John Bolton, who I've dealt with and least diplomatic diplomat I've ever met in my entire life. The notion that there's got to be complete capitulation and verifiable disarmament before North Korea gets any reward at all, which was what was on table finally in Hanoi, is not going to get us anywhere. But if we can move forward on a step-by-step basis, I think we can defuse the nuclear situation over time, because I think at the end of the day there is sufficient guarantee in Kim's mind that he's got some protection against cross-border invasion. And I think that will create the conditions for quite dramatic and quick movement towards normalisation of the country, which will make it possible in a way that's just impossible at the moment to advance the human rights agenda. So I think that things are linked in that way, but the nuclear part of it is not inconceivable that can be delivered.
I think there is some common ground between us. For example, I think it's a good thing that President Trump met Kim Jong-un. Yep. I think the place is cooler and things are better since that happened. But the normal way in diplomacy, as you would know better than anyone in this room, that you deal with a problem is you go to the periphery and you deal with issues that may be susceptible to answers, and that would lead to things in the economic sphere, railways, roads and other links, postage, telecommunications. You go to the periphery and then ultimately you move into the hardcore at the very centre, and that hardcore is survival of the present system and regime. And the problem is we haven't been dealing with it that way. You'll never hear me being rude about President Trump or even Ambassador Bolton, but I think we've got to think of ways.
You broke your duck, I think.
Huh? Well, I'm not going to go the same path as you. I'm much more diplomatic. but I think getting to the centre by way of things that would be susceptible, if we could get the Trump Corporation spending money on golf courses and so on, you'd start to build up. You'd build up the economy. And I saw this earlier in Cambodia, which is a pretty sad case still, but at least it did help to improve the civil society in that country.
The trouble is none of that's possible with the sanctions that are currently being imposed, in which the US is refusing to lift, even in a marginal way, in return for steps taken on the other side. So we somehow have to break through that impasse.
Yes, but they asked to get rid of all the sanctions. Then they later said, "Oh, we didn't really mean that."
What they asked for in Hanoi was not enough. It was to close down the one particular facility, Yongbyon, in return for a lifting of the sanctions.
This isn't
post-2016.
The way you negotiate this situation.
No, the way to negotiate is not at the summit level. Although I agree with you actually that it's to be applauded that Trump did actually take the stand, of trying to initiate something to cut through this. His understanding of the complexity of the issues was negligible, and perhaps the reasons why he did it is, just on the principle that a stop clock is right once every 24 hours, or on the principle of give enough monkeys enough typewriters, they'll eventually produce a sonnet. I think it is an element of... There's an element of arbitrariness about anything that Trump does that is ever credible or sensible.
Well,
and a question mark has to be raised.
About,
but what he did, his instinct that this was a solvable problem was right. Mm. It is a solvable problem, but it's going to require a hell of a lot better diplomacy than is on offer for Mr. Bolton.
Mm. Now, I'm breaking you up, boys. we do need to go to the audience for some questions. We'll have about 15 minutes or just over that.
Hi, I'm Aria. We're talking about AMRIS. We got to understand AMRIS in 20th century and 21st century, very different. 21st century AMRIS is dangerous, never before. AMRIS.
Nuclear AMRIS.
You know, AMRIS, we born in the space, now it's on the way, I believe. And most of the country didn't agree to go to talk and make a treaty to ban weapon in the space. That's one thing. Second, this kind of the digital warfare on Earth and out in the space with the nuclear war easily because it's so complicated, it cannot control. It's hard to control. Experts even couldn't understand how to control it, how it come from, where it come from, how it happened. So this kind of thing, it blinds us and very risky. So I asked the corrupt even, if you have any idea or you have any work, activity, go to talk with the World Institution and ask them to come to world-scale treaty of ban weapon in space and nuclear bomb.
It is absolutely critical to do something on the weapons of space issue. With current technology developing at the pace that it is, if these things are up there and not regulated in some way, then God help us, Tiny Tim. I mean, with the further advance of technology, this is serious, serious, serious stuff. This has been talked about in a variety of contexts, including the Geneva Conference and so on, at the moment, because of the complete absence of any kind of cooperative relationship between the United States and Russia. Nothing is really happening on that. It's something the rest of the world really desperately wants to see moving forward, but some concessions are going to have to be made. Certainly by US and Russia for that to happen, and probably by China now as well, because that's very much a player in the game. So, I can't agree with you more about the salience of that issue, but unhappily it's a lot of talk, but very little effective action so far.
I'll just leave you there if you wouldn't mind, because we do need to get some other questions.
But we'll pick it up afterwards.
Thanks. Ashley Townsend, US Studies Centre. I wanted to return to the question, the really important question about the nuclear ban treaty. And there's an aspect of that, two aspects of that were touched on, but I'd like you to explore a little bit further. The first is, and I agree, that its value is normative, not operational. But insofar as the normative value of the treaty goes, the way these things work is it's liberal democracies that are being pressured and are putting pressure on themselves and each other to sign up to the ban treaty. and actually the efforts by ICANN and those proposing the ban treaty are very ineffective if being implemented at all in autocratic societies, particularly in places like Russia, China, and North Korea. So how can you get a treaty that has normative value up and running in a way that brings all countries along, particularly those that we're worried about? And related to that, Gareth, you mentioned extended deterrence in a conventional respect would be a more efficient way of managing stability in an era of weapons of mass destruction. Let's assume that's possible. At this point in time, that is certainly not achievable with regards to American power in Asia. We are seeing reports of a major atrophy in American conventional military capabilities globally and in regards to the Indo-Pacific. So is this perhaps the worst time to try and push for a nuclear ban?
Well, in the latter question, I don't agree that the atrophy, as you suggest, of American conventional capability has proceeded to anything like the point where we can fear its ineffectiveness as a support for us or for the Europeans or anywhere else. I mean, the Taiwanese might be having second thoughts at the moment about American capability to overcome air sea denial capability that is manifestly significantly greater now in the Taiwan Strait by China. But in terms of the larger picture, I don't think we ought to assume anything other than America has ample conventional capability to deal with any kind of threat contingency affecting itself or any of its allies and partners. In terms of the ban treaty itself, I think what we should be doing to make the normative impact of this, you know, really get traction from that, is over time renegotiating the terms of the ban treaty so that you resolve its problems. Some of them are simple drafting errors because the thing was done with so much speed. The point that I was messing up before about safeguards and all the rest of that's pretty easily fixable. The point about making provision for time-bound commitment to elimination is fixable, but it would involve a major change of principle because it would have to accept that you could sign up to the treaty on a conditional basis of moving sort of forward. And the steps that I was talking about, the four Ds, doctrine, no first use, deployment, reductions, de-alerting and decreased numbers, you can make provision for those steps in the text of the treaty itself and make the final elimination of your stockpile contingent on your satisfaction about verification, and which is actually the ALP policy at the moment as passed at the Adelaide conference. It was publicised as agreeing to sign the ban treaty, but agreeing to sign it once it solved the problem of the verification enforcement. There are ways of modifying the ban treaty so as to make it, in effect, universally acceptable. At the moment, I mean, the nuclear armed states simply can't, with their present mindsets and the realities of their looking over their shoulder at each other's breakout potential.
I'm not so sure that's right, because the Netherlands, for example, is looking at whether it, which is in a NATO treaty relationship with the United States, can go ahead and sign the ban treaty. And your idea of just keep on talking, it didn't get us anywhere between 1996, when the International Court of Justice said that there had to be bona fide negotiations. That hasn't happened.
Michael, it is just the
I case. Think as a citizen of this country, I think it is a great pity that our government didn't recognise the movement that occurred in your city, Melbourne, and brought together the people that became ICANN, that went internationally, and that got the Nobel Prize. When they got that, did they get at least acknowledgement and recognition of the fact that they'd taken this world lead, which has been picked up by 122 other nations, which were fed up with people, the experts, talking about these things and wanted something done and something as a step on the right path? And I think it's much better that we go ahead with step on the right path and then from that vantage point move to improve the ban treaty if that can
and
be done.
And you don't mind in that context walking away from the alliance, tearing it up? Because that's what's involved for Australia. We don't have the luxury of choice.
That is not agreed to by analysis done that I've read from the Harvard Law
School
analysis.
I've read that analysis and it's completely consistent with what I'm saying.
No, but your mistake is you think that the ANZUS Treaty was based upon nuclear weapons. It wasn't. It was never negotiated with nuclear weapons expressed. It's not part of the treaty. And the United States of America has never given a commitment to Australia that it would use nuclear weapons in our defence.
Just to clarify, the Harvard legal paper, which I can... By the way, I was the first patron of ICANN, and I totally believe in what it's been trying to do, and I thought it was outrageous that the government didn't congratulate it on the Nobel Prize, and I do think it's a massive normative step forward, so please let's clear the ground on that. But the truth of the matter is you cannot, and the Harvard paper acknowledges that it all depends on whether you can, in fact, separate out the nuclear from the non-nuclear dimensions of an alliance relationship. And the paper acknowledges in so many words that if, as a practical matter, you can't separate out the non-nuclear component of your assistance from the nuclear component of your assistance, then you're stuck.
I don't see why not. Why can't we say, OK, we're in negotiation, we're in treaty with you, you protect us, we're under that umbrella, you've got enormous, you've just said this, enormous conventional weapons, we'll accept all that, just... We do not agree
because
to any use.
The Americans will find
weapons.
It difficult to communicate with the submarines that are going to be protecting us unless they can use the Northwest Cape submarine underwater communications. The Americans would find it very difficult to do any kind of. I mean,
but as
the
you
pine,
said,
the
that
pine
makes
gap
us
facility.
A prime target.
Okay.
Sorry, no. Michael. I just happen to have been living and breathing this practical delivery stuff for the last 40 bloody years. I mean, I know about this stuff.
But sometimes
I love the normative stuff. No, I love the principle, but it's
non-deliverable. Sometimes you can get too close to the details, and you need to deal with the broad existential.
You're
problem
playing
of
your
our
role
species.
To perfection.
Right.
As the meandering dreamer.
Okay.
And you're absolutely allowed to, but it's not going to work.
No shortage of either intellectual or,
we're in,
or
we
intellectual
love each other,
power
that's
or
right.
passion going on here. Now, look, I'd like to take three questions in a row because these gentlemen have had their hands up for a while and we can deal with them all together so that we've got about 7 minutes to go. So I could have this gentleman.
Thanks very much. Gordon Weiss. A question for either of you, or Gareth. Where do you see a re-energised Australian foreign policy regarding the nuclear issue? And secondly, the wild card that hasn't been mentioned is China and the rise of their nuclear capability. Where do you see that going?
I think there will be a lot...
Do you mind if I just do it, because then we can try and weave it all together.
Okay, sure.
Here, just a brief question, thank you, and then over here.
John Hallam, and I'm nuclear disarmament campaigner with People for Nuclear Disarmament. I should say UN Nuclear Disarmament. And co-convener of the Abolition 2000 Working Group on Reducing Nuclear Risks. And I hope that those last words, reducing nuclear risks, are the words that kind of get both of you off the hook. It is my strong view... expressed at a panel the other day in the Parliament, in the Federal Parliament, that what is most urgently required is actually those steps which you, Gareth, spelled out a couple of times, no first use, lowering of operational readiness and other rather boring, rather technical sounding measures to take the apocalypse off the table. Because without those measures...
Can I just ask you to get to a question so we can...
I'm hoping that I get a reaction to this. Because without those measures, we may not even make it to signing the ban treaty. The risk of nuclear war right now is as great as it has ever been, ever.
Okay, thank you very much. And then just last question here, thank you.
Yes, John Connor, no useful affiliation, but I was 2 years ahead of Gareth at high school, so he'd better listen. Really, very briefly, it's very interesting to hear what the International Court of Justice might have said. And it's very interesting to hear a long legal discussion about treaties. But in the absence of a strong popular will towards nuclear disarmament, which I don't personally discern anywhere in the world, is any of this likely to succeed?
Right. Okay. So we've got three questions there. Thank you very much, all of you.
Can I try on that last one?
Certainly.
There is a strong feeling about this. The polls that have been conducted in Australia, at least as to what people's opinions about the ban treaty and nuclear non-proliferation and destruction of stockpiles, it shows that in the general population, it's something like 75%. favourite, and in the ALP voting population, it's something like 87% favourite. And so I don't think it's fair to the citizens, but they need leadership. They need leadership. They need a leadership that would at least, even if you thought ICAN had got the bull by the tail, would bring forward those who've won the Nobel Prize for Peace and acknowledge them as fellow citizens and worked as fellow citizens of Australia in Melbourne, who got together and said, we are facing this risk and nobody's doing enough about it. So I hope that we do get change, and I think there'd be a great groundswell of popular opinion in Australia for it. We underestimate ourselves. We've got to stop doing that.
Okay, now we've got a couple of minutes left. Yeah, so, Gareth, this is going to...
Unsurprisingly, I'm in full agreement with you, John, about nuclear risk reduction. And you are the most extremely idealistic absolutist when it comes to nuclear weapons that I know. You've been campaigning on this issue around the world for 30 years. And for you to say that, you know, in the real world right now, the step-by-step risk reduction is the only really realistic way forward is a pretty big and important point to make. So I'm glad that you made it. On the question of popular will, it is the case that some of this stuff can be done top-down, but a lot of it's got to come bottom-up, and we haven't got at the moment the environment conducive to that. The big hope from the Global Zero movement, and they commissioned a big film that they were going to hope had the same impact as the Al Gore film on the environment, it just went, disappeared. My fear, my horrifying fear, is that it is going to take a nuclear accident of some kind or a nuclear exchange of some kind to be the wake-up call. To be the wake-up call that, you know, the world actually needs to change that latent sentiment, which is there, into actual realistic popular pressure. Two very interesting questions to begin with about what the Labor Party will do. I think they're absolutely committed, not to the ban treaty for the reasons I've just explained, unless we can solve the problem of verification and enforcement, but absolutely committed to putting weapons of mass destruction and nuclear weapons in particular, back centre front on the agenda. The party is much more multilaterally focused. It's much more instinctively in favour of this. We've got the record of initiating the Canberra Commission. We've got the record of initiating my own commission. It's all there. Penny Wong's very committed, and the party is very committed. So I think, you know, to the extent that we can make a difference, we will try to. On China, I am a bit of an optimist about what might be possible with China. China has never gone down the heavy-duty nuclear armament route. It's always been minimum deterrent strategies. Only got 300 nuclear weapons at the moment, although it's had the capacity for ages to get up close to the Russian or United States numbers, but it's chosen not to do so. It has been, and hope to God it stays this way, very firmly committed to no first use doctrine. So it's there for deterrence purposes only. And I think there is, you know, for all the reasons we have to fear, the chest beating of Xi Jinping and the assertiveness which is worrying so many people for legitimate reasons in so many contexts, I think there is a sense in which on a number of multilateral issues, climate, probably trade, and I think also nuclear weapons, China is genuinely anxious to be a sort of a force for global good, and it sees itself as you know, having some obligations rather than just its own internal
focus. Don't forget, China voted for the sanctions in the Security Council.
It did.
And increased the sanctions, and according to The Economist, enforced the sanctions, at least in the beginning. So
one of my answers to the questions about how Australia should deal with China in this current thing where we're thinking of it all in terms of zero-sum game or possible zero-sum game between the security relationship with the US and the trade economic relationship, I think the critical thing for our relationship with China will be to try to diversify and broaden out the relationship with it. And I do see the pursuit of a common multilateral agenda on things we can agree about. And I think climate's obviously one of them. Trade policy, if Xi Jinping sticks to that, there's another one. And I think nuclear is another one. Nobody's talking about it, but I think it's one of the things we really should be exploring. We, Labor Party,
starting
if it comes into government.
There's
not a chance in the world of that stuff being explored, you know, by the present regime, but with a change of government, I think it's on the agenda.
I think we could go on forever. I think you've got a sense of how important this debate is and where the divisions are. I want to thank Michael Kirby and Gareth Evans very much for their time today. If we're lucky, they may stay around for a quick conversation. Thank you very much. And thank you all for joining us today. And we have another event on the 9th of April
called Atrocities as the New Normal, which might help us continue this conversation a little bit, so we welcome you there too. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alex, from us all for excellent moderation.